Members, if I might, before I call it to order, this room is apparently especially susceptible to cell phones and pagers, so I would remind you that you might want to turn these off, if you could. And I will do that myself right now, if I can figure out all this electronics.
It's the red button.
Members, I'd like to call the Bioscience and Workforce Policy and Oversight Development Division to order. I don't think it's mine anymore. But if you hear a buzz, I will be reminding people about cell phones to put them away. I believe Mr. Hine. Yes, Mr. Hine. I guess I better approve the minute before we get to you. Representative Norton, I'm sure you reviewed the minutes from from January 7th. Oh, yeah, January 7th, and I'd like to move them.
I would move the very lengthy minutes from the 7th, yes.
Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Same sign? They're approved. Now, Mr. Hines, presentation of the unemployment numbers and trends. And Mr. Hines, you are the director, research director for the Labor Market Information Office at DEEP.
That's right, Representative Mahoney. Thank you very much for the opportunity to come before you today and give you a little bit of an overview of our recent and potentially future trends in our state labor market conditions. I'd also like to find the time to at least briefly mention some of the longer term trends, as the long run looks quite different than our current short term situation. I believe you have handouts with these slides, but the staff was kind enough to set me up here with the presentation. Let me begin with a bit of a look back to put our current situation in some historical context. During the 2001 recession, Minnesota lost 54,000 jobs. That's between February of 2001 and April of 2002. We then somewhat languished along with the nation for 2 years before we began to add jobs in April of 2004, and you can see this first chart here shows the state trend relative to the nation, the state being the blue line, the nation the red, and the Twin Cities area, metro area, being depicted in green there. Once we started to add jobs in April 04, by April of 05, exactly a year later, we had regained those 54,000 jobs that we lost during the recession, and we continued to add an additional 43,000 jobs over the next year. It did take, however, over 4 years, 51 months exactly, for Minnesota to regain its pre-recessionary peak of February 2001. At the point in time in early of 2006, Minnesota did begin to slow relative to the U.S. as we added only 20,000 jobs over the next 2 years. That ultimately produced about a 47,000 job gap relative to the nation at that point last December, when the nation began to turn down and also was officially declared to be in recession. Since March of this year, which is our current employment peak, Minnesota has lost 39,000 jobs through November's report. We release December's employment figures next Thursday, and while I don't know what those numbers will say precisely, I think it's safe to say that with, again, another 500,000 plus jobs lost nationally, it would be a very pleasant surprise to see us move in the other direction. Going then into the future, losses are predicted to continue through 2009. Although, as this chart depicts, the forecasts for the fourth quarter of 2008 and the first quarter of 2009, our current quarter, are projected to be the deepest quarterly job losses. Now, these forecasts are not meant to be any sort of official prediction of our job loss, but rather I derive these by applying Global Insights national job change rates to the state in order to derive a scenario for Minnesota. So if these losses, if Global Insight is accurate with regard to the national job losses, and if the state continues to track the nation closely, it's expected that we will lose another 61,000 thereabouts on top of the 39,000 we've lost so far, for a total of just slightly over 100,000 jobs lost during the current economic recession. We'll then start to see job gains in the first quarter of 2010, and currently a fairly good rebound then going forward beyond that point in time. In terms of the unemployment situation, of course, job declines are often correlated with rising unemployment rates. And again, applying the Global Insight forecast to our own unemployment situation, the unemployment rate is predicted to peak at 8.7% during the first half of 2010, well above the current, or rather November's rate of 6.4%. Again, December's rate will be released next week for the state, but you might well be aware that the national rate released last week jumped quite substantially up to 7.2%. We're also up from 4.5% a year ago, November 2007. So we've seen a fairly substantial increase in unemployment that's projected to continue to rise to that 8.7%, which does fall somewhat shy of our all-time peak here in Minnesota of 9% that was reached in November of 1982 at the tail end of the very deep recession that occurred in the early 80s. If we apply that 8.7% prediction then to the number of people unemployed, we see that that 8.7% will translate into about 260,000 unemployed people. We're slightly below 200,000 at present, and because of an increased size of our labor force, again, it would be a very pleasant surprise if we were not to exceed that peak number that was achieved in November 1982, and if we come close to the Global Insight projections, we'll far exceed that number by the time the economy, in terms of the unemployment situation, begins to improve. Some other evidence on the unemployment situation can be found by looking at some of the recent data on what we take in our office as being a pretty good leading indicator of the unemployment situation. That is the number of people that are filing for new claims on unemployment benefits. The blue line here represents a seasonally adjusted level of the number of people that have filed for these unemployment benefits over the past 10 years, month by month. We see that the number there really spiked recently and hit 33,000, just over 33,000 in December. The red line is also a good indicator in that these are the claims that are filed by those individuals that have indicated that they have been permanently laid off from their previous job and therefore are looking for a new job. And we also see that there's been a substantial increase in that to over 26,000 again in December. Both of those numbers are well above the previous all-time peaks. In these cases, Those were levels that were reached in October of 2001, of course, subsequent to the 9/11 event. I also have in the past used, you see that straight blue line at 25,000 and a red line at 11,000. Those were pretty consistent thresholds above which these levels would start to predict that we would start to lose jobs. So being at 26,000 as opposed to that 11,000 threshold certainly indicates that we should expect to see further job losses in the future. Another indicator, or two indicators, from the unemployment insurance program is the number of seasonally adjusted recipients, okay, the number of what we call weeks paid, but approximately the number of beneficiaries out there that are receiving unemployment benefits. That number has spiked, also risen by nearly 50% over the past year to end up at just under 70,000. And at the same time, the number of people that are exhausting their regular programs benefits period, typically 26 weeks of benefits, that also has increased by nearly 50% over the past year to fall just short of 5,500. We'd like to make a couple of comments on an issue that I think is somewhat overlooked. And that has to do with our focus on the net changes that we observe occurring in the economy. This chart here shows what the Bureau of Labor Statistics of the U.S. Department of Labor predicts as being the change in employment, the change in unemployment, and the change in those that are not in the labor force between November and December. Just to pick a number here that's quite telling, it's predicted that there were 632,000 additional people that are classified as unemployed between October and November. That's certainly a very large number. We've had increases that have been larger in the past, 800,000 plus earlier in 2008, but nonetheless, a pretty significant number that was that increased the overall number of unemployed to over 11 million. But underlying that significant increase in the number of unemployed are flows between the various employment status categories here, employed, unemployed, or not in the labor force, that are extremely large compared to those net changes. For example, that top blue arrow represents the number of people that have flowed from being employed in November to not in the labor force in December. And there were nearly 4 million people that left the job and left the labor force during that month. At the same time, there were almost 2.6 million people, not 632,000, but 2.6 million people that went from being employed in November to being unemployed in December. Offsetting that was a little over 2 million people moving from unemployed to employment during the month. So that pool of unemployed people, that 11 million plus people, does turn over on a month-to-month basis by nearly 50%. Okay, and I think it's important to recognize that when we hear about these increases in unemployment of 600,000 and so on, that really underlying that is a great deal of what we call churn in the economy, that there are people taking jobs, but there are also a lot more people than those net changes indicate that are losing jobs during that month. So in the month of December, somewhat over 16 million people changed their employment status during that month. Quite a significant number.
A moment.
Representative Mahoney.
Getting a number of people asking to ask a question. If the committee wouldn't mind, could we get through the presentation and then ask some questions at that point? Because I have a couple myself, so
absolutely.
If you don't mind. Okay. Go ahead.
Thank you. Just to the data that I just presented for the nation, we don't have available at the state level, but we do have our own measures of these dynamic churns, and I show you a chart here that illustrates that. What we've got here are a blue and red line that represent the number of people each quarter over the last 10 years or so that have entered employment or left employment. And then the little green bars, and they're meant to be little here to illustrate the fact that the net employment changes each month that occur from all of these entries into and exits from employment are really quite small compared to this overall churn. Again, these are quarterly data, but if we take 450,000 people entering or leaving employment in each quarter, that's about 150,000 people, Minnesotans, that are entering employment in a typical month. Now, of course, when we lose 10,000 jobs during a month, that indicates that only 140,000 people were successful in finding jobs. But again, I think it's important to keep in mind that even during these times when our labor markets and our economy are clearly slowing down, that there's still a significant amount of entry into and exit from work that occurs in even the worst of situations. So, to sort of summarize then the short run, again, we're projecting, if, again, Global Insight is correct, and I know there will be an additional official forecast that will come out in February, but I think it's not unreasonable to expect that we'll lose in the vicinity of 100,000 jobs throughout this economic contraction unless things change dramatically relative to the current forecast. We're going to add an additional 70,000 on top of the approximately 190,000 people that are currently classified as unemployed in the state. We're going to reach all-time highs in the number of unemployed, as well as the number of people that are claiming unemployment benefits and receiving those benefits and also exhausting benefits. And we're going to continue to see that considerable churn occurring. Regardless of how much the economy does slow down, there will still be people moving into and out of work at a fairly rapid pace. If I may turn a bit to a longer look, we face very different challenges as we look forward beyond the next couple of years. We're going to see a significant slowing in our labor force. We're going to see a very dramatic shift in the demographic makeup of our labor force, particularly a much older labor force and a much more ethnically diverse one. We're going to begin to see situations in which the problems are not going to be excess supply of labor, but rather a shortage of labor resources or an excess demand for labor. And that's going to raise new challenges with respect to our ability to match workers and jobs and the skills that each bring to the table. These are labor force estimates that are provided by the state demographer's office. And what I want to point out here is that in the two decades between 1980 and 2000, we added 707,000 additional workers. Okay, we typically had 6, 7, 8% annual growth rates in our labor force during those five-year spans. Beginning in next year, 2010, it's expected that the rate of growth in our labor force will be less than one-third what it was during that 1980 to 2000 period. Much of that growth will come in the form of new migrants and immigrants into our population. And to be honest with you, when I look at these state demographer forecasts,
and notice that they're based on some assumptions that our labor force participation rate is going to trend upward over this time period, considering the fairly dramatic decline that we've had over the last 8 or 9 years, that these may in fact be somewhat more optimistic than the reality turns out to be. So we may see even lower growth rate if that labor force participation rate doesn't begin to reverse its downward trend. Looking at the demographics in terms of our age distribution that we can expect to see, we're going to see over the next 10 years almost all of the growth in our labor force coming from those that are above 55 years of age. You see the predominance of those green bars there in the 5 year periods 2010 to 2015 and 2015 to 2020. Between 2010 and 2020, or rather between 2015 and 2025, excuse me, you can see that the blue parts of these charts, of these bars, are in the negative territory. That indicates that during that 10-year period, we can expect to see a diminishment, a decrease in the number of workers that are between 16 and 34 years old. It won't begin to really rebound until after 2030. So we're going to see a much older workforce, and in fact a shrinking of the younger end of our workforce. So again, to summarize those changes that we'll likely see in the long run, 10 years from now, our labor force growth will be roughly one-tenth the recent rate. We've added about 30,000 to 35,000 workers per year over the recent two decades. We tend to look at monthly job growth gains of between 2,500 and 3,000 as being necessary to absorb new entrants into our workforce. 10 years from now, that 2,500 to 3,000 is going to be an annual rate of increase in our labor force. So that would be an upward bound, in a sense, at full employment of the rate of job growth that we're able to experience under those conditions. Again, almost all of the labor force growth over the next decade is going to be in that older cohort, the 55 and above. And that suggests then that one in three people that will be in the workforce in 2035 are already of working age today. All right, so we're going to see a lot of those older workers require a constant or frequent update in their skills. We're not going to see the regular P16 pipeline source of new skills entering the labor force. That means that reskilling existing workers is going to become more crucial. With that, I am certainly willing to entertain questions.
Well, the prerogative of the chair is to always go first, so, and I have a very short question. Are Global Insight predictions on a historical scale accurate or not?
Well, Representative Mahoney, I think one telling indicator of that is that they're one of the few forecasting firms that are still in business, and in fact have really captured a great deal of market share. Forecasters don't stay in business very long if they're frequently inaccurate. There are others that spend a great deal more time assessing the accuracy over time. I will say that Global Insight and many others have been adjusting their forecast with an increasing rate of frequency lately, and generally those have been adjustments downward. So we've seen a big change in their forecast between September, October, November, and most recently December.
Thank you. We have a few questions from some of the members. I think Representative Burnett? Burnett? Did you have a question? No. So I guess it's Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hine, I know, and Mr. Chairman, we've got a serious problem right here with the current turmoil that we're in, but I'm looking out here just a few years from now. I mean, we've been here, what, 6, 8, 10 years now, Mr. Chairman? Which
do
seems to have flashed by. No. No, but just remember when I came here, I thought you were an old head, and it turned out you were just a couple years ahead of me. But the point is, this moved quickly, members, and I'm most concerned about looking here on page 7 at your charts, because for a couple of years now, we've been talking about some incredible shortages in some of the skilled areas. My wife is in medical care, and the nursing shortage has been a real problem until just lately, which I think is a temporary hiccup, because this too shall pass. But the thing about the growing older workers on your top chart on page 7 there is one that gives me pause. First of all, would you give us a brief description of whenever you're defining the workforce, what ages do you count? And then I've got a follow-on that's related to that, Mr. Chairman. When you're talking about workforce,
The workforce is defined as those that are of working age 16
and to.
And then there are, again, I referred to those assumptions that are made about the share of that working age population that are either working or actively looking for work. That defines the labor force.
Do you have a top end age on that? Or is it just wherever somebody decides to opt out on their own?
Right.
Okay, so some retire at 50, 55.
That's exactly right. So you do see, you certainly see lower participation rates among the older cohorts as an increasing share of them do go into retirement and therefore leave the workforce.
As things get tighter then, Mr. Chairman, what I'm concerned about is can we, or should we be assuming that that top end number is fixed? And I think you're just answering the question. Because as the new entrants into the workforce, and we're facing our public school K-12 population is actually shrinking in this state by, 33,000 students over the last couple of years. I'm seeing that's only 10 or 12 years out the other end, and then they're going to be in this blue box I think you've got indicated on this chart. That concerns me a great deal, because when my time is done here, I'm looking at buying another business, and I'm going to need some of these kids to work for me. Should I be looking maybe at McDonald's, at the old retired guys club, and be thinking about hiring them? And I guess that's just my question. What can we do, or is there hope that we have for bringing people back into the workforce that have maybe opted for retirement and they're sitting around bored, or the cost of living has gone up and they have to go back to work? Is that taken into account when you're doing this kind of research?
Let me say that, first of all, the estimates here do come from the state demographer's office. Those people are the experts on the demographic changes that we're expecting to occur. You're absolutely right that it will not be far down the road that we're going to be in an environment in which we're going to need to be looking at every source of additional labor resources in order to keep businesses staffed at levels that they need to be staffed at. That would require perhaps an increasing share of the retirement age population, the increasing share of our population that are immigrants or migrants into the state. So I did want to bring this information to this committee in order to emphasize the importance of those considerations.
Well, thank you for doing that, Mr. Chairman. There's lots to ponder here, particularly as we come out the other end of this thing, that we're going to be back into the singing the verses we were singing just a couple years ago when every skill group was here saying we need more mechanics, more electricians, more nurses, more airline pilots. Where do we find these people? This is something that we shouldn't lose sight of while we're in the middle of the turbulence that we have right now. But perhaps I'll hold some more questions for another time, a little later in this day.
Thank you, Representative Beard. Representative Poppy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a follow-up to Representative Beard's comments, too. I work at a community college, technical college, and I know that as we're facing right now, not as many students coming in, so there's the threatening loss of some of those technical programs because they are costly to continue to have. So this is good information. I appreciate it. I have a question about the turning a little bit.
God, I was hoping we weren't going to try that one.
I'm curious about a couple of things, and then you can give more information maybe, but what's the definition of not in the labor force? You've talked about who is in the labor force. What actually does it mean to be different from unemployed to not in the labor force?
Thank you, Representative Poppy. Good question. These are based on what we refer to as the official definition of unemployed and not in the labor force. There's been some discussion in the media lately about broader measures of unemployment. The official measure, in order to be considered unemployed, you need to be, of course, without a job, mm-hmm. be available to work, and also have actively sought work in the last 4 weeks. If you do not have a job, so in order to be in the labor force, you have to either be unemployed by those criteria or have a job.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So not in the labor force would be those people that are not working and have not actively sought work in the last 4 weeks.
So they, Mr. Chair, just to follow up then, so they could be people who are retired, who have chosen to be no longer in the labor force?
That's right.
Correct. But they could also be people who have given up to some degree, temporarily or for long term.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. They would include what you refer to or are referred to as discouraged work.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's certainly been an increasing share of these people that are not in the labor force. They're a subset of what are referred to as marginally attached. That do not meet that criteria of having actively sought work in the last 4 weeks. They may be marginally attached because they're discouraged, but they're a more frequent, numerically more frequent cause are that they face other impediments to taking a job. Child care and transportation issues, for example, are the most frequently cited by those people that are marginally attached but are not necessarily discouraged.
And Mr. Chair, could I have just one follow-up on that? Regarding then the unemployment and not in labor force, are those, should we be concerned about the fact that the unemployed is at a lower number than the not in the labor force is? What typically should that look like? Is this typical, the chart as we're looking at it, that this is how it, the numbers may be high, but is it true to look at an unemployment that's very a small box compared to a not in labor force?
You're asking about the relative size of those mm-hmm. green bars.
Mm-hmm.
Is that fairly typical?
Yes.
It is. It's about one third of the working age population.
Mm-hmm.
It does tend to drop off in recessions, and so we have seen some diminishment in the size of, I'm thinking of the labor force participation. We do tend to see more people dropping out of the labor force, or less people being attracted into the labor force by more wider opportunities. And so we have seen somewhat of an increase nationally. We've seen a more significant increase in that share of the population, the working age population that has not been in the labor force within the state. We peaked in terms of our labor force participation, that is the share of our working age population that are either employed or unemployed, just before the recession of 2001. It wasn't much of a surprise throughout that recession that we started to see a decrease in our labor force participation rate, but that's continued to decrease. Currently, we've lost about 120,000 participants since early 2001. Had that participation rate either maintained or bounced back to its previous level.
Thank you.
Members, we have five people that have questions, and I'm more than comfortable. We've been informed that Commissioner McElroy and Wilson will be here approximately at 11:30, so we've got about 20 minutes just to keep kind of in mind. Representative Gotwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Mr. Hines, following up on Representative Hilty's question, I appreciate it because it was mine as well, but some more detail about the Green Parties I think would be very useful. It would be good to know a little bit more about where those people are, what their situation is numbers-wise. You know, are they truly retired? Are they people who have simply given up on the workforce for the time being? Are they seeking additional education before they come back into the workforce? If they are out of the workforce, are they? How are they subsisting? Are they living on unemployment or social service programs? If you have any of that analysis, I think that would be very useful, frankly.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Galtwald. We're actually trying to develop a methodology for really tapping into some of the information that gives rise to these national numbers so that we can somewhat replicate these at the state level. We also are hoping to get a better handle in that methodology on another group of people that are not included in here, in the green bars, and that is people that are employed part-time but would prefer to work full-time. The way the employment numbers are tabulated here, a job is a job is a job, regardless of whether it's 5 or 10 or 40 hours a week. So, you know, some of the increase in unemployment, if you will, is somewhat understated to the extent that we are seeing more of those part-time workers that would prefer full-time. I also heard a story on NPR this morning about a study that I'll have to find that looks at the underemployment of immigrants that, you know, have college degrees but are driving taxi cabs and the like. So there's another example of that.
Mr. Chair, I'm glad Mr. Hines brought up the immigrant piece. Back on page 7 again, I'm curious as to whether these bars, as we're looking across them, include that point that you made about the demographics, that we are going to be relying more and more on immigrants and newcomers to our state to bolster our workforce. Is that incorporated into this analysis? Are these numbers reflective of that influx that you're predicting?
Representative Galtwald, yes. The state demographers' data here does break this out into natural population growth, immigration, and increased labor force participation. And their forecast of this 226,000 workers occurs because of the expectation that it will be the immigrant population and increased labor force participation that gives rise to this, sufficient to more than offset an actual decrease in the natural population growth. And again, I have some reservations about this assumption that we're going to see increasing labor force participation, although in reference to the earlier comments about bringing more of our older workers back into the labor force, or keeping them in the labor force, may bring that about.
Well, Mr. Chair, that remains a concern as well, and I'm sure for members of this committee and the state in general. If these numbers are reflective of what's going to happen, even with the immigration that we're expecting, we're in for a world of hurt.
We are going to face different challenges that we currently face. Absolutely.
Final question, Mr. Chair, if I could, and it relates to this. Any information that we can compare to other states, because we're going to be in an economic development battle with other states as well as globally if we want to increase our economy and build jobs and businesses. How does this stack up against other states? Because if our workforce is drying up and businesses don't see the opportunity for the kind of workforce they're looking for, they're going to go expand somewhere where there is the labor force. So any general comments on how we stack up against other states?
Representative Galtwald, I would be speculating to a great extent. Much of this is simply a result of the baby boom generation coming of age. I think we came of age a long time ago, but you know, that has been a national, in fact, international phenomenon. Now, certainly, you know, days like this may cause a renewed interest in flight to warmer climates, but I would only be speculating about what the state demographer has in mind underlying some of the estimates of migration and immigration.
Thank you.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hine, I guess there are two slides shifting the conversation a bit that really I find concerning. The first is the first chart that you have on page one, which is a chart of employment.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at 2006, beginning in 2006, when the economy was not in recession, we begin to see this pattern emerge of Minnesota having a lower employment number than the nation, which is previously charted together very well. And suddenly you see this big gap open up in 2006. And I guess I'll get to a more specific question, but it seems to me that the most important question that we could possibly get an answer to is what happened in 2006 and what has continued to happen since that time to make this structural change. Because we will go through economic downturns as we are in now, and we will come back. And if so long as we are continuing to follow the pattern of previous years, as the nation's economy comes back, Minnesota's comes back. But this change is different. It doesn't track cyclical trends. The second slide is on page two, the bottom in our handouts here. It's not numbered, I guess, but it's rising unemployment rates.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a different, right? You have unemployment versus employment. This is the unemployment page. This is 2006, 2007. And again, we see that even through 1982, during that terrible recession, we were doing better than the rest of the country. And yet when we get up to the 2006-2007 time frame, there seems to be this structural change that happens. And again, this seems like the most important question we could possibly need an answer for to understand what's going on. And I wonder if you can begin to provide some light as to what has happened.
Well, thank you. That's an excellent question, and much better than any answer I'll be able to give to it. But you're absolutely right. Our history, at least recently, has been to fare significantly better than the nation. We barely felt the 1990-91 recession. 2001, we were really in very lockstep with the nation. We turned down at the same time. We decreased jobs at very much the same rate. And throughout both of those time periods, and back to the beginning of our data on the unemployment rate, we have been on average about 1.5 percentage points below the nation in unemployment. All those things began to change in early 2006, as you noted. We began to add jobs at a much slower rate than the nation, and that continued until the nation went into official recession a year ago. We first matched the nation in our unemployment rate in early 2007, and a couple of months we've been above it. We've been very close to it throughout that time since then. We did notice in early or at least mid-2006 that the impact of the precipitating event for this recession, that is the housing market correction, began to have an impact here in the state before it began to impact much of the rest of the nation. We were particularly exposed to that by virtue of the relatively high concentration that we have in areas like wood products manufacturing. Those areas began to feel the impact of the housing market slowdown earlier than we saw it affecting other areas within the nation. Of course, since then, the housing market situation has spilled over into credit market conditions and affected other industries like automobiles that were a little less exposed to, and much of the rest of the economy, the nation's economy has caught up to us in a sense. But again, there's a lot of speculation as to whether we've lost our luster in a sense here compared to the nation. Whether we'll regain that once the particulars underlying this recession have sorted themselves out and are a thing of the past, but it's certainly a reason for some concern that we do no longer have that advantage in our unemployment situation compared to the nation, and that we've been losing jobs earlier and more rapidly than the nation.
Mr. Chair, a follow-up then. I understand that this is not an easy question to answer, and it may take some time to understand what the trends have been. But who, as legislators and as a legislature, who do we look to when we're trying to find that answer? Because as we're dealing, obviously, with the short-term economic and budgetary crisis, obviously our focus has to be on long-run performance of the state.
Mm-hmm.
And the sooner we can get answers to what the trends might be that we can address, the better. And I don't know if it's you, I don't know if it's the state economist. I've heard conversation about housing before. And you know, maybe in a year or 2 years we'll find out that, well, it was just housing. Minnesota was particularly badly situated for a housing bubble to occur, and we took the hit much harder than other places because of the unique portfolio of our economy, I guess. But is there another way to get information faster about what we're looking at and what we might expect, aside from waiting?
Thank you for asking that. I have had conversations with the state economist and others. There have been these clear contributors that are certainly inadequate as full explanations, I'm not aware of any comprehensive explanation for this that's been put forth at present. We're still trying to understand the Great Depression,
right.
So it's certainly a challenging set of circumstances in terms of being able to fully and accurately explain what's driving this.
Mr. Chair, we have a lot of debates at the legislature about how our actions are going to affect the economy, improve the economy. We should have higher taxes and more services and more education, lower taxes, more competitive business climate. We should invest in one industry versus another, try to get a certain set of jobs through economic development programs and others. And the takeaway I get from this essentially is we don't really have enough information to make any kind of informed decision about what kinds of areas we should focus on if we don't even know the structural change. And I'm not placing this on you, but it seems to me if there is a way to better inform our policy and fiscal judgments, we should develop that or have, whether it's economists at the U or the state economists or your office, there should be some way that we can better inform our decision making. If you have any, knowledge of what other states do or ideas of what we might be able to do to get decisions based on information instead of ideology in the legislature.
Yes.
We call the fun out of legislating.
I couldn't agree more, not only from a self-serving perspective, but also as a previous economist in a former life. Certainly as... especially when conditions change as dramatically as they have, and the challenges that are put forth by, recognizing that no two recessions are alike. There are things that we can learn from the past, but we certainly face a different set of circumstances today than we ever have in the past. But you're right, good, accurate, timely information about both causes and the future consequences of policy actions is vital. I wish we had more of it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, after a comment here, Representative Hilty, unless I understand we have lunch at the end of this committee, I think it's at 12 o'clock, I may allow the questions, I'd like to allow the questions and the witnesses an extra 15 minutes at the end of the, and rather than javeling it done at 12:15, I still would like to give us at least 45 minutes for lunch if at all possible. So, Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hine, Mr. Chair, I have a couple questions with your indulgence, but Mr. Hine, first of all, page 2, the card about current and projected job loss. Can you tell us what underlies the assumption of that we're going to begin to add jobs in 2010 at the rate that is projected here? What is projected to happen to cause that?
Certainly Global Insight uses econometric modeling and judgment and predictions. They do include, for example, stimulus bills that will be passed at the federal level, assumptions about the extent of time that it will take for such things as housing prices to begin to increase, credit market conditions to begin to loosen. In reference to Representative Mahoney's question about the accuracy of Global Insight, they've got an incredibly complex process by which they make these predictions, and not having those resources available, I'm more than happy to rely on their expertise here to essentially interpolate their projections to the state level. I don't think that there are many other predictions, forecasts of employment that deviate from that eventual expansion in early 2010 by more than a quarter or two. I think that's a fairly widely held expectation about when job market conditions should turn around. But other than to have read their description and noting what they assume about the passage of stimulus packages and the like, I can't really say what may have caused them to pick that quarter.
I'm afraid that what it is that's the way it always has worked.
I would note that if the current recession were to continue through all of 2009, it will be quite significantly longer than any other recession that we've had since the Great Depression. But I wouldn't view this as a particularly rosy scenario.
I would agree with that. Mr. Chair, Mr. Hine, one other question. This kind of goes back to the discussion that Representative Poppy began, and maybe we have already addressed this, but you mentioned in conjunction with the slide on page 6 that we're experiencing a continuation of a downward trend in the labor force participation rate. What is the explanation for that? And also, how do we account for self-employment in all of these figures?
Thank you, Representative. That's a very good question. The information that we get comes largely from two sources. One is a monthly survey that we conduct in conjunction with the Bureau of Labor Statistics of employers, asking them how many people appear on their payroll. So we'll call that the payroll survey. It's often referred to as that. The other survey that is conducted also in conjunction with the BLS is a survey of individuals, asking them whether they're working or not, and if they're not, have they actively sought work in the last 4 weeks. The first of those surveys, the payroll survey, does not include self-employment, because they have to be on a payroll of a business in order to be counted as a job holder. The other survey of individuals, of households, does count self-employment. I would note, for example, that our decline in employment in this chart of 806,000 is somewhat greater than
the jobs number decrease of 525,000, 24,000 that was released in December. The difference there is in part just because of statistical randomness associated with each of these, but also they're asking different individuals different questions, and some of this may reflect a decrease in self-employment as well.
And Mr. Hine, the trend in participation in the labor force.
Okay, thank you. We've broken that out by age groups. Certainly, we have seen a continued decrease in the participation rate of young people, high school and college aged people. One may take that as a positive sign that they're concentrating more on their schooling than work, and certainly the sort of the demise of those, you know, pizza delivery truck jobs paying $12 an hour has had a great deal to do with that, the lack of opportunity for a lot of younger people taking low-skilled jobs at very high rates that we saw in the late 1990s. But we've seen a decrease in the participation rate, both in men and women, overall. Men's participation rate has been in a slow but steady decline since Ward Cleaver days. Women, on the other hand, that was the source of particularly Minnesota's advantage in the labor force participation rate. Our female labor force participation rate was by far the highest in the nation at the beginning of 2001. I believe we might still be at the top in the net, but our advantage has diminished significantly. You do see that the decrease has been greatest amongst women between 25 and 45, and there's been some fairly heated debate in the media over whether that is indicative of women being more likely to stay home and raise families, and there's pretty compelling evidence to suggest that, in fact, it's not for the purpose of family-related activities, but something else, and what that else is, I have not been able to intuit from the debate. The one age group where we have seen some increase in participation lately is, of course, amongst the 55 and above.
Thank you.
So much like the earlier questions, the question is much more satisfying than a lot of the answers that we're seeing in that regard.
Thank you. Representative Norton?
I'll do.
Well, the commissioner is being tied up by the governor, as I understand it, at the present time, so...
Must be a curious spectacle, Chair.
Duct tape, Truman, what can I say?
I had an hour and a half long version of this presentation. I couldn't
make it up. We need to reschedule the two commissioners, because I know I had at least 15 minutes worth of questions for the two of them at this particular point. I know other people had other questions for them, too. So,
well, I will just comment, then, if we've got a few moments. I think three or four of the people here have already raised some of the questions that you have and have not been able to answer that I think we'll be dealing with this year. But a couple things popped up to me. One is the need for attention and retraining that will be needed based on your numbers for growing older workers and shrinking younger ones, that I think is going to be worth noting. And part of that training need is going to have to be in technology, because we know that many of the new jobs in the next, you know, as your chart shows up through 2020 are jobs we haven't even envisioned yet, and we're going to rely on older workers to fill those jobs who don't have the training or skill in the new technology that will be come available. So I think this committee and others are really going to have to struggle with trying to you know, in some sense predict what those needs are going to be and make certain that we have job retraining and education available for that workforce, which is going to be a challenge. And also, I think the other comment I would make had to do with you're not in labor workforce. I think we also are going to have the challenge of perhaps needing, and it's a need, to motivate people who are choosing not to be in the workforce to get into the workforce, because we already know that our K-12 population is not going to be large enough, and potentially our immigrant populations will not be enough to fill the needs we'll have in our state. And, of course, depending on what those needs are, that may even be more true. But we're going to have to perhaps motivate some of those people with, you know, I don't know what. I don't know what the motivator will be, whether it is the opportunity for education and retraining in a challenging area that, you know, maybe they didn't think the door was open for them. So I just lay those out there as, you know, challenges for us and being creative and keeping that focus out in the years. And
so are we kind of looking at a Supreme Court justice retirement age?
No comment.
Representative Obermiller?
Mr. Chair, I don't know that asking the judges for the justices to retire will generate jobs quite fast enough for what we're going to need.
I was a little worried about the average age of 84 years old, something like that.
Mr. Hine, my question, I have a couple of questions for you, and the first relates to the bottom chart on the page 6 of your presentation. Those are the Minnesota numbers, and the workforce obviously getting much smaller over the next 20 years, but are the national numbers the same? Are we competing with states that are also going to be having the same kinds of shrinkage?
Representative O'Neill, to the extent that this is largely driven by that baby boom demographic shift, we're certainly going to see that nationally. Now, there's certainly differences between states that are driven by various rates of immigration and in-migration, as well as, I suppose, labor force participation and some of the differences in natural population growth. But while I would imagine, and I'm not the expert here on these data, particularly when it comes to looking at other states, I would imagine that if it's not one-third in other states, it's going to be comparable, that we are facing this challenge as a nation, rather than we're not unique in this respect.
All right, Mr. Chair, follow up for me. And for one of the things we have to be aware of here is that we're going to be competing with similar problems in other states. In other words, it's not enough just to say it's Minnesota, we have to attract qualified workers from overseas or send our jobs there. We're going to be competing with Minnesota and Texas and other places for the places to do it. And members, I think one of the things we really have to be aware of is the fact that we're going to have to think about what brings, you know, the young families, what brings the working force, the top quality workforce that we want to the state, you know, making sure we've got the quality of life. I think your comment was Minnesota's lost its luster. That's a scary thought to me. We're not going to attract the 55 crowd that is in this market or in this other chart here from Florida. They're not coming up here, I don't think. So we're going to have to try to figure out how to attract those working families. The other question I had for you was whether or not the methodology for counting the people who are unemployed includes the people who are who would like to work but can't because of child care or transportation issues or health issues, those types of things. Are those numbers included in the unemployment kind or the not in the workforce number?
Representative Obermiller, let me back up to your earlier comment. You know, we saw a real dramatic increase in the number of immigrants that were choosing Minnesota relative to recently. And I don't think it's simply coincidence that attractiveness began to dissipate as our unemployment rate advantage disappeared. You know, these people are by and large looking to relocate in order to take advantage of job opportunities and Minnesota looked particularly attractive during the 1990s because of, you know, what was at times about a 2.5 percentage point advantage in the unemployment rate. Regarding the question on the more comprehensive measures of unemployment, you know, at the national level, the Bureau of Labor Statistics produces six unemployment rate measures. This official rate of 7.2% in December that attracts the attention in the media is what's called U3. U6, the broadest measure, would include these discouraged workers, the marginally attached people that can't get to work or don't have child care, and also the part-time workers that would prefer to work full-time. That hits 13.5% nationally in December. And I have submitted a proposal to use the information that these estimates are derived from at the national level and try to develop methodology for accomplishing a similar sort of measurement for the state as a whole. So I do hope that if we were to meet a year from now, we would have some of that information available.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hines, going back to what Representative Winkler and Representative Overmuller and others have asked you, I do think a competitive analysis would be fantastic. If we have some statistics out there that are roughly apples to apples from other states and perhaps even internationally, knowing that picture is really important, I think, to our decision-making here in Minnesota, because it is a competitive environment. You're absolutely right. We also need to consider both sides of the equation, not only how we attract new workers and the labor force of the future and train them, whether they're older or younger, immigrants or whoever they are, but we also have to think about how we're going to attract the job creators, and that's just as important. How do we create an environment in Minnesota that is attractive for people to start, expand, and keep businesses here in Minnesota? And I think that's vitally important as well. What are the jobs of the future, and how do we get those employers to locate in Minnesota so that we have the demand for the kind of jobs we need and want?
Members, for the TV cameras here, we really don't have enough time to have the two commissioners, so we will be rescheduling them. And having said that, Representative Hilde, I think you had another question?
I did. Thank you, Mr. Chair. In terms of keeping track of employment or lack thereof, what are the sectors that you define, and how detailed is the information?
Thank you. Like I said, we conduct this monthly survey currently of about 4,000 businesses across the state, in everything from healthcare to manufacturing to construction to government. The level of detail that we can produce these employment counts at, of course, is limited by the fact that we're only sampling 4,000. But nonetheless, 4,000 does allow us, I would have to look at our website and count them, but statewide, we estimate, I would say, 40 different industries, month to month. We often look at the 11 major industry sectors like construction, manufacturing, trade, transportation, utilities, financial activities. There's 11 of them that would cover a fairly significant chunk of the state economy individually. But we also break that out into as much detail as that survey sample size would allow us to do.
Well, Mr. Chair and Mr. Hine, then wouldn't it be possible to go back to 2006 and pinpoint sectors in which the kind of precipitous drop
occurred? Yes, absolutely, and we have done so, and you can see that in those areas like wood product manufacturing, certainly residential construction and the specialty trades within, you know, that were immediately impacted by the housing restrictions. Some of the areas that have been negatively impacted nationally, like mortgage banking, for example, have held up very well here. So, you know, we've seen a financial structure here, and the players in that financial activities industry be able to weather that storm. So certainly to the extent that we have been able to identify some of those precipitating events, it is done exactly as you described, by looking at some of that detail to try to identify what's being impacted. But we've seen some of the more secular declines in some of the areas within manufacturing. But then within other sectors within manufacturing, like electromedical device manufacturing is one area that has been strong, and we're particularly well situated here in Minnesota and has done quite well.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Hine, currently, what is the, in terms of employment, what is the largest sector in Minnesota?
Depending on how broadly you define them, the trade, transportation, and utilities would be the largest. I've got all of the underlying data here somewhere. But
we're working on to the hour and a half version.
Trade, transportation, utilities has over 500,000 people. So really depends on how you define that. That's also the largest individual sector at the national level as well.
And how do you define that?
Well, there's this hierarchical classification scheme called the North American Industrial Classification System that everybody uses. In fact, also Canada and Mexico, it came out of the NAFTA agreement as a uniform way of describing each of the trading partners' economies, and so we follow that structure.
That always makes me happy. Mr. Hines, Mr. Hilty, Representative Hilty, if I might, commissioners, I want to thank you for coming today, but there's really not enough time for the presentation and the questions that we asked. So if you allow us to reschedule you next week or as soon as we can, we would appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman, we apologize for having come in late. We were participating in an event with Governor Plessy and Governor Doyle. We would look forward to the opportunity to have time to discuss the issue with you and your staff.
We all have bosses. Thank you. Barring any other questions, I'm going to make a couple of comments and then I'll adjourn. Mr. Hines, thank you very much for coming today and your hour and a half presentation.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney, and everybody on the committee.
And I want to say, you know, when you've called over there, you've been very helpful. I'm sure you extend the same courtesies to any of the members of the committee that would call over there. You have a tremendous amount of information. We have a chart coming out with all the jobs or the majority of jobs that classifications in the state next week, and we'll be presenting that through your research. Members, I do want to know. I do want to note that we have a work cut out. I mean, it, certainly from today, we're going to see the fact that you know, we're not growing the way we're going to need to grow in order to keep the state healthy. And in order to stay healthy, we're going to have to retrain, as Representative Norton brought to the table and others have brought to the table, how we get workers retrained, how we, maybe it's the science fiction of my youth with robots or whatever, I don't know, but we still have to manufacture, we still have to take care of people. We are charged in this committee with how do we train those people. I want to, in your packet today, I want to, hopefully all of you will have on your schedule Science and Technology Day on the Hill, which is the 29th, which is the day after the presentation of the 2025 report. Hopefully you'll all take a look at that. We have a special meeting with the numbers of the unemployment that were brought up today, we have an unemployment extension bill that's coming through. And in order to get it done in a timely manner, and not get it caught up in the politics, if this place can get caught up, we're trying to push it through relatively quickly. Thursday the 15th, right after the immediately after the State of the State, we will be holding a fairly quick meeting that my vice chair will get the chair, and I will present an unemployment extension bill in room 300 South. And we'll send out an email to everyone. Hopefully, the 10-15 minute presentation, and then it will immediately go down to the Higher Ed Workforce Committee to be heard, and move on from there. We are trying to get this out relatively quickly to give DEED the time to make sure their computers are up to snuff on it when it becomes effective. Am I missing anything? Barring anything else, this meeting is adjourned. Thank you, members, and take advantage of Mr. Hines' information. Thank you.